you know, one of the things that that I would like to get into is the issue of, you know, individual rogue kind of behavior, bad behavior, and then systemic issues that may exist that would promote that behavior, or at least allow it to rise up, you know, and continue. So I think it's more, for me, my perspective, and I'll explain why when we get to that. It's more of a systemic issue that needs to be addressed rather than the individual personalities. Yep. If we want to affect change. And so, you know, from a tax-paying person who, you know, whose money is going to support these individuals, not, you know, specifically any particular one, but in general, I think we need to be able to recognize the importance for examining what allows these conditions to exist. And it's been pretty horrific, really, when you consider, you know, the way they have attacked Graham Hancock. It's really despicable. And so if you want to start, unless we've already started.
I was listening to you going, that's going to make a pretty good clip right from the beginning. We'll just put right there, because that'll probably segue right in grid to where we're going with the rest of it.
Earlier today, I had the pleasure of interviewing Christopher Dunn. Now, for the handful of you who don't know who he is, he's the guy who wrote Giza Power Plant, The Lost Technologies of Ancient Egypt. He's done all kinds of stuff. You could find tons of videos that he's been in over the years. He's stuff from the 90s of him on YouTube. It wasn't uploaded in the 90s, but videos from the 90s, interviews and seminars and stuff like that. He's an old school pyramid idiot. So I had a chance to sit down with him, and we talked for about an hour and a half or so, a little longer. I edited that footage together so you don't have to wait through all of the breaks and whatnot. I'm sorry if I look a little tired, because I was already feeling a little rough, but here we are. Hope you enjoy this very much. I certainly enjoyed talking to him, and this should be the first interview between me and Chris of many. Hi, my name's Dan, and welcome to Dedunking.
And quickly, I couldn't agree with you more. As a taxpayer, it's like, you know, if we're going to be contributing to this,
right,
there's got to be, and it's clearly a societal issue in their field. It's not, right. Otherwise these people wouldn't be allowed to act the way they do. They get to run around with impunity, and that shouldn't be a thing.
Right. Right. And it's just a few bad players, a few bad apples, I think. I hope it's not. I mean, I know some good archaeologists, and there have been archaeologists that have commented on my work and followed me. There have also been historians that follow my work and seem to enjoy it, or at least they don't object too loudly to it. And so, you know, I mean, it's basically having the freedom to speak your mind without fear or being attacked unnecessarily.
Yeah, or unfairly.
Unfairly?
In my opinion, it's one thing for an archaeologist, even if they're mean-spirited about it, it's one thing for them to come at you and be like, this whole vase thing, this is all just hooey, this ancient technology is all just crap, this is it. That's one thing. But if they come in there and they're like, oh, and by the way, it's attached to racism. It's like, whoa, 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 dude, come on. You lost the plot here, buddy. You just threw a red herring into what was already, it was kind of, you're already being a little rotten, but at least you were in the right wheelhouse. Now you're just off in the weeds somewhere screaming at everybody. It's a pretty bad thing to be screaming.
Yeah.
It's pretty despicable, like you say.
But the you know, the thing is, it's kind of selective too, and you know, if to talk about what is racism and you know what why that is used, it's a it's kind of like an ad hominem attack. And in the case of the attack on Hancock, and you know, the protestations that they were not, you know, inferring that he was a racist is, I think, as you most eloquently put in one of your videos, just bullshit. And so, you know, it's kind of like, yeah, no, you can't argue that. Only a simple mind would think that anybody would buy that. But it's like a poisoning the well, you know. And it's an old political tactic prior to a debate. Politicians use it all the time. It's being used right now in Washington. You know, if you want to know what logical fallacies are, all you have to do is open the politician's briefcase and they'll all come spilling out. But the but the attack on Graham Hancock, I think it was must have been deeply hurtful for him, because knowing him and his dear wife, who is a beautiful soul, it would have even more hurt and pain attached to it than if it had been like somebody like me. And you know, my wife is a wasp, right? And so it's like, you know, it's just despicable. That's all I can say. And anybody who supports that kind of work coming from a professional, you know, it's really disappointing. And it's kind of like, wow. What expectations are on these professional academics, these professors in universities, who are drawing off the public purse? What policies and what holds them to account? What guardrails, you know? What are the expectations of their behavior at on the job and off the job? Because, yeah, you know, as a professional, and having an association with a larger organization like the company that I retired from, which is a very respected Midwest aerospace manufacturer, and I am sitting on their board of directors, what I do publicly reflects back on them. I mean, any organization that you are associated with, whatever you do in your private time will, you know, reflect back on that, the organization that you're attached to. So, so yeah, you know, you have to be careful.
Well, yeah, it's clearly a way, like you said, to poison the well. And right. I would imagine, I've only met Graham in person the one time, but I met him in Santa, and yeah, they're both really kind-hearted, warm people, just really just open salt of the earth kind of people, despite not being a tool belt wearing guy. As I've said it before, he's old enough that when they got married, he's going to have been called race traitor. And then in his latter years of life, his twilight years, he gets to hear people calling him racist. I mean, I'm certain that would just have me bristling the whole way through. It's like, fuck, man, I missed the 90s when I didn't have to deal with this for a few minutes there. He's got to be thinking that. But
you know what's really funny, though, Dan? I'll tell you a story. It's like, yes, they even... These debunkers, or the you know, the kind of scholars or people who are arguing against lost technologies and the idea that the ancient Egyptians were more advanced than what we give them credit for, they even suggest that is taking away from, you know, the true nature of the ancient Egyptians, and they're being dishonored by me saying that. And the opposite is true, you know. So it's kind of like they trip over themselves in their desperate attempt to slow down or stop progress. stop outsiders or those outside their own field from contributing to knowledge.
And that goes against everything that the Society of American Archaeology is supposed to stand for. You know, in their original constitution, one of the very first bylaws is they're expected to contribute to like encouraging and fostering the love of archaeology with the interested amateur and offering assistance. Now, get this part, Chris, when asked. If they're not requested to be assisting, according to the old days, they weren't supposed to be sticking their fingers in the pie. But nowadays, it's like they don't need an invitation. All they need you to do is say something that they can construe with archaeology, and boy, oh boy, they're going to be in there with both feet. And and they have zero concern with whether or not they alienate you. And right. I mean, let's be clear, the most interested amateurs in archaeology you're going to find on the planet are quote unquote pyramidiots, hands fucking down. There's more of go turn on Netflix and you can watch the most interesting thing mainstream archaeology has put out in a long time is Cave of Bones. I don't know if you've seen that, but it was a pretty interesting show about Homo Naledi and a cave that it looked like they were deliberately burying their dead in and using fire. And it was pretty interesting.
Right.
And it got like a tenth of the views that Ancient Apocalypse season one did. You know, it's not as interesting to people. So when they alienate us instead of doing like Carl Sagan did with the alien people, right? He catered to them. He answered their questions. He spoon fed them science with a little sugar in there of aliens and made the medicine go down. These guys that have no concern with that at all. They're just like, fuck you, you're wrong. And that's all there is to it.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I mean, as far as the whole alien thing is, I've stayed away. What most people don't know is that even though I have been on Ancient Aliens, I have always refused to associate Ancient Aliens with ancient technologies, because I don't think the evidence is strong enough to do that. Also, it seems to be a catch-all solution or conclusion that is reached when you don't have any answers for how something is made. And so what you have is you have presenters who will look at these artifacts with bright-eyed wonder, and then the conclusion is, well, it must have been aliens because they can't explain it. But there's another part of that too. I mean, there is that I object to, and I've objected to it to some of the people who actually make the claim, and it is that what they are seeing that has been manufactured in the ancient past cannot be done today. And I object to that because, you know, it's kind of like you have a, say you have like this, you know, the vases, the pre-dynastic vases. And people look at that, well, we can't, you know, these can't be made today. That seems to be a popular saw that people will elevate. But those who make that claim really don't know what engineers today are capable of doing, and today or in the past, you know. And it's like even talking to modern machinists, of which there are hundreds of thousands of them now, who are accessing these kind of videos. And took an interest in the whole vase project. They said, "Oh, you would definitely need to have CNC to produce that." You know, if the work that Mark Viss did on the mathematics and the geometry, I thought was extremely impressive, but the and he concluded that it must have been a Turing-type machine, like a calculating machine, in order to be able to create those geometries and then execute them in igneous rock. In other words, machine them. And But I've always maintained, I think that, you know, there are ways that you can create those vases without CNC. And, you know, there are machines that I am aware of and knew and worked with in the past that no longer exist in modern machine shops that were replaced by CNC. And so when you go into, you know, into my work history back when I first came to the States, in aerospace, they were using machines like, they call them Keller machines. These are three-dimensional profilers. And they cut dies, molds, various aircraft parts, using wooden models and the stylus that follows the model and then actually actuates the axis on the machine to machine that particular shape into metal. So it was done. I mean, those parts were made very, compared to today, very inefficiently, but they were made.
Yeah, you know? You work with what you got.
Yeah. And so when you look at, you know, the features on those vases, and we can talk more about that in another conversation. But when you look at the features on those vases, to just limit your perspective on how they could be made to what is available today is the wrong approach, in my opinion.
I would agree with that. I'd even take it to when that same idea. I would take that all the way to the moving of big rocks and stuff. If we decided we were going to start moving 500 ton stones across this planet, bigger than anything those people did back in the day, we could daisy chain cranes across the whole damn planet if we absolutely wanted to. We have some pretty powerful tech nowadays. Besides Mother Nature, we own this bitch. Mother Nature still tells us which way things are going to happen, but beyond that, man, we tell the rock, we tell the earth which way the water is going to flow. I watched it happen in 94. The Mississippi River flooded really big and chomped up St. Louis and St. Charles, Missouri was going to be underwater basically. And the Army Corps of Engineers was like, no, you're not. River, go back where you're supposed to go. But after the flood, nature had a different idea and humans said, fuck that noise. And that's the biggest river on, you know, in North America. So, but that's not to that mentality. I agree. It's taking it too far. But if in between that, you have some real mystery there, if people are willing to actually discuss it and take it serious, is how were these vases manufactured? How were these big rocks moved? Right. How did they do these things so precisely, considering what they were working with? I know some of the skeptics will take you know, issue with the word precision, but they can lick me where I pee. I really don't care. They're going to cry about individual terms and get pedantic like that's bullshit. The fact of the matter is, when you look at things like the vases and you compare them with their own counterparts, some of these things are very precise. No two ways about it.
Yes, I mean and I think, you know, basically when you start describing these remarkable objects, sometimes people get overly excited and may, you know, use words that are inaccurate. Like, say, they may say, "Oh, that's perfect," right? That's a perfect part. And so you will find people will quibble with the use of the word perfect, because nothing can be perfect.
Yeah.
but you'll hear it all the time in the shop, you know, where you will have tool and die makers or machinists, you know, and how they're working to particular tolerances. You know that working to tolerances, some tool maker puts together a complicated die, you know, and you've got cams coming in, sliding in from different angles, and their supervisor comes back and he goes, well, how's it going? Is everything good? Yeah, it's perfect. And let me see it, Ron. Let me see it. Okay, it takes a look. Yep, you're right. Perfect. Great. You know what it means? Mm-hmm. It means that it meets customer requirements. And that's basically it. We're working to satisfy a customer.
Yeah. It's that way with everything. If you look at coin grading, card grading, any of the collectible stuff where they send them off and get graded, something's a perfect 10. Just because it's a perfect 10 doesn't mean that if you break out your microscope that it's still going to be perfect. And if you compare it with another one, there's going to still be differences, even if the other one's a perfect 10. That's just, it's the nature of the universe. You can try to stamp things out identical as much as you want, but there's always going to be a little bit of a difference. That's just the way things are.
Right. You know, and it's the other stumbling block for a lot of people, I think, is the using the word advanced. Mm. So, you know, basically it's like, okay, advanced compared to what? I had an article published in 1984 called Advanced Machining in Ancient Egypt. It was focused on the work of William Flinders Petrie. And so what he was describing in his book, Pyramids and Temples of Giza, and based on my experience in machining and tool and die making, he was describing something that comparing the product to the tools that are available in the archaeological record, that the objects were more advanced than what those tools could produce. And so basically, you know, the question then becomes how advanced. And so, you know, when were humans capable of producing work to this level of precision and quality? And so that is basically the central question. When was it? In the 1800s? Was it in the 1900s? It certainly wasn't, you know, it doesn't appear in the Western civilization until the Industrial Revolution, slightly before the Industrial Revolution. But you did have precision work going on, you know, the printing industry, I think, with the platens that went up into the printing industry, they had to be fairly flat, and so they knew how to lap flat surfaces. And so then the question is, you know, when you're looking at these ancient Egyptian artifacts, it's like, okay, at what point in history were they doing this kind of work? And there's no record or tools available from the dynastic period to explain it. And so there's a huge gap there. And it may not be answered in my lifetime. But the solutions that have been put forward by historians, archaeologists, academics, when they do experimental archaeology, such as like Dennis Stocks with his hole drilling with a copper tube and sand. they don't really answer the central question. They don't replicate the most important features of the work. And so, you know, it's something that I think we need to keep pushing on. Yeah. In order to improve, because as long as, you know, that they are, it's their job, they're being paid to do the investigations and inform the public of the truth, and they're ignoring a very, very important part, which is what happens in the culture of manufacturing. And, you know, when you look at some of these artifacts, and you, if you ask the question, okay, so we have this vase, and we want to recreate this vase. Who has the skills and knowledge to be able to make a perfect replica of it? Perfect within the tolerance of the original object. And so, you know, you follow a reverse engineering kind of process where you take measurements, and you have to have very highly detailed measurements of the object that you want to recreate. And then you have the task of selecting the process, the machines, and the people who have the necessary knowledge and skills to be able to produce. It happens all the time. It happened all the time in my lifetime, where you would have, you know, a customer come in with a part. They don't have any blueprints for it. They just have the part. They know the material of it, and so they bring it into your shop. They put it down on a surface plate and say, I want you to make another one exactly like this. Well, we don't just go off and, you know, we don't look at it or take a couple of photographs and then go out and start whittling away and make something that kind of looks like it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. You've got tools to measure that stuff. Right?
That's not the way it's done. It's kind of like, you have to take very highly detailed measurements, create your own drawings, and then build a process and execute it. So, you know, the what is required of modern manufacturers is an exact replica, not something that, you know, well, it's close.
Within tolerances. Right. Yeah, thousandths of an inch we're talking here. So.
Yeah, but, you know, the other silly argument that you hear on these, from these
what's people, that?
Is that, well, you know, this was their first try. If they keep, you know, the ancient Egyptians had 500 thousands of years to perfect their skills, you know, and it's like, yeah, okay. So what you're saying is they were using copper saws and copper chisels, copper tubes to drill and sand and wooden mallets and stone balls, and they never improved their tools over 1,000 years.
Yeah, that's a fair point. That's a very good point. The thing that to me that's funny about the guys like Sacred Geometry Decoded or the Scientists Against Myths is, like, when I first started looking into it, it was like, okay, this is interesting, this is a good start, but when you do more research, or their cynicism is very telling in the fact that they don't have much of a framework to keep their stuff stable while they're quarrying it to begin with. And that just basically says right off the bat that they're not concerned with the precision of it, because in my thinking, that is really where the besides the things like the inside being carved out and the handles and stuff, the rubber really hits the road as to the precision, as to how you would hold that thing and keep it stable while you cord it. That's some hard shit to do, and keep it perfect. Even like the idea of lapping the sides with an abrasive and getting that curvature with, you know, some sort of a jig to hold your sandpaper in place. Same kind of thing. The stability required is something that I think people that don't work with tools would have a very difficult time recognizing that. It's just a tiny bit of vibration, which moving tools vibrate. I mean, yeah. As a guy who's worked around a machinist, I'm well aware that if something's a little bit off kilter on one of those lathes, they'll drop everything and get out the levels and make that fucking thing right where it needs to be, because otherwise that thing, you can't have that thing at all. No. You actually have to be careful how fast you cut metal, because certain metals will vibrate and stuff if they're cut at a certain cut too fast. I'm preaching to the choir on this one, but.
Well, you're preaching to a journeyman machinist you have what you call any instability. You have what you call chatter. So you might set up vibration in the piece. You know, there's all kinds of different reasons. But certainly you have, you know, in the old days, the bearings and the spindles were not as accurate as they are today. And so, you know, you have a situation today where the worst quality or precision on a piece that comes out of a modern machine is better than the best that came out of a machine 50 odd years ago.
Sure.
Right. And so you have the variables that have been worked out of the manufacturing process, which has, you know, resulted in the improvement of and function of a lot of our products. You know, you look at a car, you bought a car off a lot in 1970 and compare it to a car today that's manufactured today, there's really no comparison. And that's all because of the advance of manufacturing with machining and also computers. Computers have made a huge difference.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
But that's I do kind of want to beat on that point for a second, because I know that I rub shoulders with a lot of skeptics, or at least yell at them a lot nowadays. But yeah. The reproducing a hole in a piece of granite is not, with primitive methods, is not reproducing a vase. I think anybody that's a researcher in the community. Now there are going to be people that are, you know, they're casuals and they watch these videos for fun. And some of them might not know that, that all of us are going to agree that a copper tube with some sand will bore a hole in stone. And the Egyptians did do that in places. There's no question. It was done all over the ancient world by certain people in certain places, right, figured this one out. That doesn't mean that's baked, that has fuck all to do with precision. So that we all can see that can happen. If it's not precise hole, I don't care. So I think that's something I kind of want to make sure and hammer home here. So sorry.
No. Yeah, you know, the thing is that a lot of the misunderstanding and confusion, I think, comes with yeah, on one side, you have an entire culture that is fully versed and familiar with what it takes to manufacture precision in an artifact. And then on the other side, there's a huge wall between the rest who have no clue. And so, you know, until you have actually done the work and made mistakes and know what it takes to actually what goes into it, you know, I don't think badly of those who, you know, don't understand or don't know. And I think too that associated with their skepticism is a certain amount of ideology, because, you know, people are very, very slow and reluctant to give up a traditional viewpoint or, you know, an education that they've received in high school and in college about the nature of our existence on this planet. So somebody comes along and says, hey, well, what you've been taught is wrong. And there is a reaction to that. And I think that's a big part of it too.
Absolutely. That's in their mind, they would say, well, just like you're versed in machining, we're versed in history. And that's acceptable to a degree. But when they avoid the more difficult questions like that, it's like, well, you know, we're talking about something here that you guys are deliberately removing yourself from the conversation by ignoring it. So it's like when the three big stones at Baalbek are discussed,
right?
That one's one that they just brush it off. And it's like, well, if you're going to brush it off, you leave a vacuum. So who's going to, people are interested. People wonder how these things were moved. And you're just saying, the ancients used ropes and sticks, man. Shut up and don't worry about it. Okay, well, you guys go ahead, don't worry about it, and then the rest of us will step in and talk about it. And then you're going to cry that you're not part of the conversation. You're a bunch of pseudoscientists talking about what fucking come and talk with us. Well, we're just going to tell you all to shut up and just, you're a bunch of idiots and defer, trust the science. It's like, okay. But you know, you do realize that science like questions things like this. They don't just say, we know. That's not science, buddy. That's religion.
Yeah. Trust the science is like the most pseudoscientific phrase that you could use. It's like, no, you can't trust the science. There's no settled science. Don't trust it. Yeah, somebody says trust the science, man, you're probably talking to a charlatan.
That's just it. I just say it's great for somebody that's trying to manipulate somebody else. It's a great thing to see. You need to trust the science, buddy.
Wrapping yourself in the mantle of science. There is that. That's the new religion, and you know, people do. They wrap themselves in the mantle of religion. You know, become godlike, and certainly, if you're attacking them or you're questioning them, you're questioning God, and man, you're going to go to hell. and so, you know, this is the way people kind of defend their positions is they run for protection.
Yeah, we're just kind of wired to do it that way, it seems.
Seems to be.
Sad, but true.
So what is a pseudoscience? I mean, what is pseudoscience? Pseudo-historian, pseudo-archaeologist. Pseudo is fake, right? Yeah. And false. And so, you know, there's been a lot of accusations. You know, the name calling is really not necessary, especially coming from supposed professionals and, you know, people that you're paying to give you good information. But the name calling is pretty lowbrow. So calling somebody a pseudoscience, pseudo-archaeologist and stuff like that, that's wrong. I wouldn't call, you know, people, you know, an Egyptologist like Zahi Hawass, I wouldn't call him a pseudoscientist. Or Mark Lehner or some other Egyptologists, but there are certainly some of their utterances in the past would cause you to question, you know, their adherence to the scientific method.
That's exactly what I was thinking as you were saying that. Perfectly worded, in my opinion.
Yeah. If I go back and watched, what was it, The Mysteries of the Pyramids or something, it was a documentary that appeared around 1987. There was a scene inside the King's Chamber in the Great Pyramid, and and Zahi Hawass and Omar Sharif were in the King's Chamber. And then if you fast forward, the interesting backstory there, though, in that documentary, it's pretty grainy. I mean, you know, it's old tech, right? I think you had Mark Lehner, who is American and very well known American Egyptologist, and he is at I think it was at Highclere Castle, you know, Lord Carnarvon's family home, and so they're looking at artifacts at Highclere Castle. He's nicely dressed in a suit. And then he's in Egypt, and he's all decked out like Indiana Jones, right? He's got his blue shirt, his Stetson.
These guys.
and his blue jeans on, and he's, you know, walking through Egypt. But if you go to, if you look at the clip where Zahi walks into the King's Chamber, he's just normally dressed. He's got a, you know, conservatively dressed. He's wearing a red cardigan, and so he's, you know, talking to Omar Sharif, and their conversation is very interesting. I'm sure you'll enjoy it. But if you fast forward right after that, and the backstory is that Zahi was kind of impressed with the way, with the look that that Mark Lehner was sporting, and so he adopted the whole Indiana Jones look too. So you, the next time you see Zahi Hawass, he's got his cowboy hat on and wearing his blue jeans, and yeah. So everybody's a cool dude. You look good in the Stetson, man. I think we ought to take you to Egypt.
Well, I like to go one of these days, planning to.
Yeah, I don't know, so if I'll wear a Stetson. Couple. I mean, there's a few instances where, you know, Egyptologists, they tend to introduce pseudoscientific ideas, or, you know, or ideas that are not based on science, but they are more based on ideology and things like magic and stuff like that. So,
well, one of them I talk about this one quite frequently, but it's, I do it because it's the clearest smoking gun of that. The carbon dating that Mark Lehner and Zahi Hawass did under this one was done under David Koch. The Koch Foundation, when they paid to have the carbon dating done on the Giza Plateau, basically the entire fourth dynasty dated about 200 to 300 years older than the written timeline. So what do? They say, well, they must have like had old wood, and they did like a fire, and they made a bunch of charcoal at once, and they used that charcoal over the next few hundred years, and that's how this happened. So you would assume that they had a site for this charcoal pit. No. You'd assume they have some evidence or a written. No. They just conjure this up out of thin air in order to reconcile these two things and keep that written record on a pedestal. And it's like, well, that's clearly pseudoscientific, my friend. One of these is hard data, and the other one is a written story. One of these is subject to being played with, the other one not so much. And so for them to just to come up with just, you know, well, they must have had, it's a whole lot different, in my opinion, than, I mean, maybe some other culture just came and showed them how to do it. You got as much evidence, buddy.
Well, you know, when there's not much else and there's so much confusion, you're looking at, different cultures that move into a particular area, and they leave their own mark, rubbish. You have middens that they're going through different layers. How do you sort all that stuff out? Because, you know, and you mentioned the written record, or, you know, the introduction of written records, or as I think her hearsay. So you have, you know, an issue where you're introducing secondary, it's not best evidence, but in today in a court of law, if you had a written record, for it to be foolproof and accepted by the court, you would need to have somebody who had actually created that written record to testify that the written record was accurate, or the interpretation of it was accurate. So, you know, you've got situations like that. And so, you know, you have, and then you have the whole kind of what's going on in a person's mind, you know, what is influencing their analysis, their decision. And, you know, we're all affected by that. Like, you know, it's called a cultural bias. You know, what informs you, what is informed you over your lifetime, and it's not just professionally but personally, and, you know, your nature and nurture, you know, what you bring into this life and how society has affected you.
Yeah, I prattle on about psychology all the time, so you're preaching to the choir on that one. Yeah, it's kind of a interesting thing to look at the dynamic of this playing out from a psychological perspective is kind of crazy. It's like you see Like I try to stay out of politics as much as I can, just because politics is it's a good way to alienate people. And the vast majority of people that weigh in on this shit nowadays really have no business weighing in on it. So I just kind of feel like there are a lot of ways that you can see, you know, there are a lot of places where the same things that politicians do, like you were saying earlier, how politicians are know how to be, they're the ones that know how to do some sneaky things. You see right. A lot of the same kind of things coming out from the scientific community, that the archaeologists, especially when the ones that are like accusing people of being a racist, that right there is that shitty ass lawyer word speak. I didn't actually accuse. I'm not, you know, you're the kind of person that they would call a con artist. No, I'm not saying you're a con artist. I'm just saying you're the kind of person that they would call right. a con artist. Fuck you.
Yeah.
this is the shit. If this is stuff that if you're playing a Dungeons and Dragons game and somebody starts that crap, he doesn't get invited next week. It's just bullshit.
Yeah. Yeah. This is revisionist history where, you know, through. Through the mind of a modern person, you know, that they look into the past and examine how things were done and what was said and who the players are, and then they judge them based on modern values without giving any consideration to what were the norms in that period of time. And so, you know, back in the Victorian era, it was perfectly normal for English people to be very chauvinistic, and you know, to a certain extent, a lot of them still are. and so, you know, that's just human nature. It happens all over the planet. You know, nobody is immune from that. People will gather in groups where they feel comfortable and are in agreement, to the exclusion of other groups that they don't particularly care to associate with. I mean, that's just human nature.
Yep. And internal zeitgeists happen. Right. I often compare that to sports teams, you know, like here in Spokane, like the high school I went to the high school the first year it was formed, and they hired a wrestling coach that was a really good wrestler, and he'd been a state champion, and he was just built like a shit brick house, and he came in there to establish a wrestling program there. And there was one other school that was really big, and these two schools are still 30 years later are still the premier wrestling schools in that bracket in Spokane. There's a team there's a school that has good pitchers for baseball, and there's a team that has good catchers for baseball, but it's just these internal things form. And in the case of the Society for American Archaeologists, for example, that one of those internal things that they've allowed is the allowance of political ideology to be running around in a lab coat, or in this case, a Stetson, but running around pretending to be a scientist. And it's clearly ideologically motivated, has fuck all to do with actual science. Had less to do with science than that charcoal pit that I was talking about 5 minutes ago that they just made up. It's completely based on what they believe, and yeah, not even on the field, just what they believe in the ballot box or when they watch YouTube videos.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead. Take a break.
Let's explore the link between, or the difference between, what is a lie and what is a affirmative fallacy.
Sounds like a plan.
And the affirmative fallacy is, I don't think, very well known. But I think it's good for people in all walks of life to have a really good understanding of what logical fallacies are and be able to identify it and identify logical fallacies when they're listening to somebody speak, listening to somebody, you know, trying to sell them something, which most people are, right?
Brought to you by
brought to you by, and now a word from our sponsors.
Even Charlie Brown complained about that one.
So, you know, the question is the lie. Okay. So let's talk about the lie a little bit. And let's say it seems to be a kind of a, I don't know, a trigger word that is being used. I noticed that it's being used a lot on YouTube, on the meme thumbnails that are generated for YouTube videos. And I know the accusations have gone around about certain personalities having lied, and I'm one of them. And so, you know, I'm fair game. I'm a public figure, even though I don't want to be. So, you know, if we, let's talk about Flint Dibble for a bit. You know, poor old Flint, he came into, he came into a so-called debate, and he was armed with all the logical fallacies and you know, arguments that have been made for many, many years. And the question becomes, if we put Flint on the stand, you know, and try and make an argument that the guy lied, what kind of defense would he put up? And I think what we have to do is look at it from a different perspective than the way we have been, because, you know, it raises tempers. It kind of, people become solidified in their viewpoints and they don't want to even considering changing. So I'll go back to the 1990s. And it was when Graham Hancock first started his website, grahamhancock.com. And he had a message board on his website. Have you ever been to his website? And,
yes.
Okay, so if you go, you can go back to between 1998, I think, when he started his website, around that period of time. And I had been also doing, having conversations and debates on since 1995, and it started in on the Deja News, the alt archaeology message board on Deja News. That's an old service, and so the thread I was alerted to the thread that was discussing my book, not my book, but my article from 1984, and so it was advanced machining in ancient Egypt, and particularly the discussions was about the Petri core number 7 and the spiral groove. So anyway, that's just an aside. We can get deeper into that at a future discussion when we actually focus on the Petri core number 7, because that's too much information to present right now.
But yeah, just for the viewers really quickly, we're going to be going through the plans to go through like videos on each individual artifact. At least currently that's the idea, right?
Well, yes, I think those that you feel we don't have sufficient answers to.
Absolutely.
And that you have information, you know, or even if people, you know, for your audience, submit questions that you might want to address in a future episode. That might be a good thing.
All right. But so we're going to be talking about Petri Coin number 7 for like an hour or something like that at some point. That's what I want. I don't want people to be like, a lot of times I'll get the, don't mention something and then not talk about it. We're going to go into depth on it in the future. That's the reason we're.
Well, yeah. And there's right. Yes. Yeah. It's definitely in the books. It will happen.
It will happen. Okay. Sorry.
Maybe in the new year. But the, but anyway, so this discussion was on that. Then my book was published in 98, the Giza Power Plant. And I was on Graham Hancock website discussing it. And so I spent quite a few years discussing back and forth with certain individuals about the lost technologies, the ancient Egyptians being a little more advanced than what we give them credit and basically, you know, to very little support from the posters on the board. A few were not as rabid towards me as others, but but what I it was educational, definitely educational. And so what I want to point out, anybody who, you know, would join Graham Hancock's message board or, you know, website, and they could go back in the archives and do a search and read the threads that I was in discussion with different personalities that are raising their head now. And so all these modern day YouTube videos that are now being presented in and objecting to lost technologies were discussed on that message board
25 years ago.
Everything, all the same arguments, you know, pertaining to the boxes in the Serapeum, Petri Core number 7, the pyramids, were they tombs or were they not tombs? And all the various arguments were discussed on that message board. And the players involved were pretty much academics.
Yeah.
One of the principal contributors to that message board, who argued with me, or, you know, we had a discussion, let's say, was a person who used the name R.K. Solenhofen. So that is a pseudonym. And he was very, very slick, very clever. And his responses and arguments would always be followed by a long list of sources, books, journal articles, all nicely typed at the bottom of his post, according to the Chicago Manual of Style or whatever. But it was all very professional and very academic, but we didn't know who he was. Still don't know who he was or who he is.
John, so, that's why my money's on him.
But yeah, I mean, I learned from that I would not, I will not associate with anybody who goes under a fake name unless I can, you know who they really are, where they're coming from, because I think that is the first lie, right? You're talking about what is a lie. That's the first lie, is using a name that is not your given name. But there was a time during a discussion when I had published an article, I think, in Atlantis Rising magazine. And R.K., the dear fellow, said, send me that article. And I said, well, send me your address with your given name.
I'll mail it to you.
And I will mail it to you. Oh, you can email it to me. No, give me your name and address, and I'll send it to you. And he wouldn't do that. So.
Of course.
Anyway, but his work is evident in these videos that you will see if you watch World of Antiquities, if you watch Ancient Presence, SGD, you'll see the thumbprint of R.K. Solenhoff and also the cited resources that he used. So none of these, all these modern, you know, YouTubers are creating these, you know, videos. They're not the originators of the ideas. They're getting their information from these sources. Now there were other players involved.
Sure.
Back then.
But these guys are all leeching it from the places that it's pretty typical in the YouTube world. And you'll even see it with memes. You'll see it where one person will do it and then 10 other people will repost a similar exact same thing practically. It's very, very common in the YouTube space for people. And the fact that my channel's doing well says that there is, but there in most people's minds, there isn't much of a market for things that aren't really one-sided. So if you go on there and say, we can replicate the core drilling, but we can't replicate this. So we're not really sure how they did it, but we are sure that we are into something here. That if they go at it like this, their video's not going to get millions of views. But if they go at it and they're like, Christopher Dunn is fucking wrong, and here's the proof. Well, now they've got something that people are going to watch. So it's sad, but it's the reality of it.
Yeah. I mean, that's basically been the, I think the grasping at straws, you know, they're trying to salvage what's left of their market. And the old saying, follow the money.
Oh yeah.
You know, they're losing market share. And so they're using advertising tactics to shame or, you know, disfavor the competition, which is people like you and me.
Well, all they would have to do, literally all they would have to do, would be give these kinds of ideas a fair shake. But they built an audience already. A lot of these guys, you know, like you mentioned World of Antiquity, Dave's got, his audience doesn't want to see him come out there and give people like Dr. Martin Sweatman or you a fair shake. They want blood. When he comes in there, they want two men enter, one man leaves. So if he makes a video, like he'll make all kinds of other videos, but they don't do nearly as well as his debunking videos. And those are not, you know, they're not very scientifically open or anything. You know, sometimes he takes shots at people that are pretty easy. So, you know, in my opinion, when somebody starts getting into psychic crystals and stuff, it's like, well, I mean, you come up with whatever you want, but we can't really prove any of this shit, right? So you just may as well just, you're writing fiction now, buddy. But generally speaking, when he takes his shot, like his videos on Martin Sweatman, for example, are so mean-spirited. His second one is just, it's just like, God dang, dude, that's just brutal, just brutal. At that point, you're stuck. Milo Rossi, Mini Minuteman, he expressed at his last video on Ancient Apocalypse, he said that he wants to quit doing debunking videos. And for about 6 months or so, he did just that. And his views went way down, and he wasn't making as much money. And so he turned around and started making debunking videos again. And, well, now he's back on track. It's funny they accuse us all of being grifters when the reality of it is they're not adhering to the scientific method that they claim to prop up so heavily because their grift won't let them. They need to be an asshole. Otherwise,
well, you have millions of people cruising the internet that on a daily basis looking for a fight. And you know, that it's no different than when you were in high school, right? I mean, you got two guys in the schoolyard who put the dukes up and they start fighting, and you've got the whole schoolyard, everybody in the yard comes around and watches and picks sides or whatever. So that's it. I mean, and that is really a business model that has been used by modern media, the news media. They, and you know, it's a grift. Yeah. It's a way to sell advertising and make money. And so they invite, you know, the people who they want to divide people. Yeah. And I think they've taken it too far, but you know, it's human nature.
I completely agree with you there. I think that it's, they make these, if you write an article and you are part of team A, if you write that article that sufficiently pisses off team B to where they share your article anyway, you just doubled your revenue. Good job. And so, yeah. Now the country is a little bit more splintered on account of that, but whatever, we're eating steak tonight, boys. So it's like, goddamn, right. It's brutal.
Right. So anyway, but back to the, let's get back to the Graham Hancock website. There was another of the skeptics, very, very, very smart people, very, very intelligent and, well-read and well-spoken. But I was in communication with him privately, and he sent me an email, and at the bottom of the email, he had forgot to delete out a thread, that a communication that he was having with other people. And I get to read who he was communicating with and what the communication was about. And it was with research librarians and basically what they were doing was, if a topic came up from what they considered to be a alternate historian or whatever, they would put a call out into the university libraries to do research and provide them with resources or citations on academic journal articles or books that actually deal with that subject. So, you know, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but there was a tremendous amount of concern when the internet first cropped up and when these message boards first cropped up and when people like Graham Hancock and others were getting attention. There was a lot of worry about their popularity, and they needed to shut it down or dissuade people from entertaining those ideas.
Yeah, that's that I do know that John Hoops was on during the BBS days. You're old enough to remember those days, and I'm old enough to have been a kid fooling around on the BBS as a little bit young adult. But he was on like FidoNet and shit. So if you remember that, and so there's not much doubt in my mind. I know for a fact that he was involved in the early days of the internet in the anti-pseudoscience stuff. And this, like we were talking about, this kind of zeitgeist of a team having a school having a good wrestling team 30 years later, he kind of injected this win at all costs kind of attitude. It seems right out the gate, because we have, like, if you look back, you can find scientific article like, E.C. Krupp, he's an astronomer, and I read his books and stuff. He's into archaeoastronomy, but he debunked the Giza-Orion correlation with absolute hogwash, absolute bullshit. Claimed that it wasn't Leo at the time. He says, oh, it wasn't Leo back in those days. In 10,500 BC, Leo wasn't the constellation you would see if you looked due east at the spring equinox. It's like, dude, you could get away with it back then because there was no stellarium. You could just go download and look for yourself. But now, anyway, my point is that there was that attitude of, you know, fake it till you make it, whatever, win at all costs, I guess I should say, right, is really just, it's, well, now it's kind of blowing up in their face, to be honest. It took a while, but now I think the cat's out of the bag. A lot of people have seen that these guys are completely happy to be totally full of shit in order to win their debates. And that's, I mean.
Yeah. But back to, you know, my previous comment about the responsibility of these institutions and to put the guardrails, you know, what are there any policies on, I mean, you know, we are told that we need to work through archaeologists or historians and be instructed before we start researching the past. And, you know, it's like, okay, are there certain rules, regulations, or it seems to me that these rules are just arbitrary and made up on the fly. And, you know, so, okay, if I don't have to, and you don't have to either. That's the thing, you know, they can make all the rules that they want, but I don't have to follow them. There's no law that says I have to go to an archaeologist or a historian before I write my opinions about ancient technology.
That's right. You know?
But anyway, so, but it would be nice if they did have policies in place on how their professors interact with the general public.
That would be, it's the kind of thing, to be honest with you, I believe that they're supposed to have things like that, but they've kind of, again, it's the political ideology thing. They just kind of let things lax. Like, universities are traditionally left-wing spaces. That's not, that's not a controversial thing to say. And you see it with guys that are notoriously right-wing that have tenure. Guys like Jordan Peterson, where they can't fire him, but they sure as fuck don't like the way he interacts with the public. So they constantly have him going to classes to re-educate the way that he talks to. we can't fire you, but we could sure make you go to, we could drag your name through the mud a little bit. And they do the best they can. So I you know, when you turn it on the other way and you've got a guy who's just full bore, like John Hoops, where it's every time he talks about Graham Hancock, he throws the entire left-wing litany at him. You're a misogynist, racist, capitalist, fucking capitalism. He accuses Hancock's books of promoting capitalism, which I don't even, there's a bigger dead giveaway that he's a screaming lefty. I can't think of it, but anyway,
wow.
Yeah, that promotes capitalism. What the fuck?
Wow.
Yeah. My point is that he's a left winger at a college. He doesn't have to worry about that kind of censorship in this current political environment, which is a sad thing. But the frustrating thing is the guy that you would bring these complaints to is almost certainly either going to be extremely left leaning or tolerant of it at the very least.
Yeah.
Otherwise, he wouldn't be sitting there. Or she, no. Or they, sorry.
I don't know. That the stuff they write is unreadable to me. I mean, it's...
I make a point of going through it and dissecting it and pointing and laughing at it. But yeah, quite frequently. The whole litany is these concepts have a... The words that Graham Hancock uses, ideas that have a history of promoting racism, white supremacy, misogyny, sexism, colonialism, and capitalism. It's like, I can't, I'm sure that there's probably one or two other ones he wanted to put in, but he knew they'd be too far. But it's like, when he says capitalism, it's like, well, there is a price tag on the back of the book, so I guess you got him there.
Right. I think we expect too much from educators in history, archaeology. I think we expect too much from them. and they expect too much from themselves. The when you consider the civilization, culture, broadly as a country, and then when you start to, you know, at a 10,000 foot view, then you start to focus in on these different groups and subgroups and subcultures, and there's millions of them, and the work that is performed within the a country by its inhabitants, it covers a vast array of different trades, skills, knowledge, too numerous to mention, but still there are subtleties that are in existence. There is resident knowledge that is learned and informs any person who is practicing a trade or a craft or anything. And a lot of that knowledge is not transmitted because on a daily basis, they're communicating with people who, similar to them, already have that resident knowledge already baked in. And so they don't need to fill in the gaps, so to speak. But when you have the general public that is interested in a particular subject, and that subject is what happens in a manufacturing company, or what happens in a workplace, then they don't have that background or resident knowledge to understand what has been written about it, then they become confused. And they may misinterpret what they read. So what we have is the educators who they are educated at a particular level. So, you know, they go through high school, university, onto college. They will learn a history. They may specialize in different countries, different periods, which are all very, very complex. But I think that there is a lot missing in that, and they do not access the information or try to understand the subtleties that actually may have been present when the ancient craftspeople created the ancient world. So I like to give them a bit of a break on that, because it's like they are performing to expectations. They're following the same, you know, that they've been trained to perform and think in a particular way, and so I don't think that they intentionally lie. I do believe that they will use selective evidence or selective information and leave it out of a discussion. For instance, when you had a video with Dr. Andrew White, yep, and he was talking about the use of selective information as though he was an attorney arguing for a client. And so you do have, and that's a furtive fallacy. That's what they call a furtive fallacy. That's when you use just selective information. Well, you can't do that. I mean, and to be open about it, I mean, we know it's going on, but to actually admit it, I mean, I never expected I would have somebody actually admit.
Yeah, I was kind of blown away too.
I was blown away, and it's not like you know, he's the only person who does that. I mean, I've seen it's been done by different people on both sides. So, you know, it is a it does seem to be a way to get your point across without.
Oh, absolutely.
And so I think when, you know, Flint Dibble was on the Joe Rogan, he was putting out citing resources or sources that had been given to him. In other words, he had basically received his training. What are they going to talk about? What's Joe going to bring up? Well, Joe had been very interested in the drilling of granite. And so, okay, so if Joe brings up the drilling of granite, these are the sources that you say that, well, that's already been settled. It's been debunked, you know. Yeah. Scientists Against Myth, World of Antiquity was used. And he just threw out those sources and that kind of, and then moved on, like it was a settled issue. I doubt, I don't know if Flint Dibble had even accessed those sources and read them.
Yeah.
Similarly, when he cited the ice cores from the medieval period, when, you know, Hancock was talking about the going back to the Ice Age, and he just rattled off a source, and it was basically, you know, well, it's this, this, and then, you know, does the soft shoe shuffle, and he's moving on to something else, and so that is a affirmative fallacy. If he knew about these other sources, or if he had just been prepped and that was the only source that was given to him to argument.
Yeah, there are cases that I would agree that you could give him the benefit of the doubt and say that maybe he just made a mistake there. But there are other times that it's pretty clear that he was being dishonest. Most of these ones were on the fly, like when Joe pressed him on accusing Graham of white supremacy and stuff, and he kept asking him, did you say that? And Flint's like, well, no, I said that. No, I didn't say that. It's not in quotes. Well, yeah, I said that. But I didn't say, no, yeah. Well, And the other time when he talked about plant feralization and when plants return to the wild, and Joe asked him, he's like, how long would it take for plants to return to the wild? Oh, thousands of years. Well, exactly how long? Well, I'm not really sure, but yeah, it's a long time. It's a long time. He didn't know. And that's the kind of stuff where, you know, if we're having a conversation, in my mind, it's like we talk about a different archaeologists, the different styles there. Mm-hmm. I don't have a problem with somebody, like giving them the benefit of the doubt. I don't have a problem with somebody believing what they were taught in school, then coming into the space and then making their own videos and even addressing stuff if they disagree with it. But it needs to be done with, like, honesty. Like, there's a dude, Nathaniel Folsom, I think his name is. He's an archaeology channel that's boring because it's just an archaeologist talking about archaeology. But when he debunked Graham Hancock, he was like, he's watching Ancient Apocalypse. He's like, well, I don't really think that's not really the way things are, actually. If I were to look into it, I think that I would disagree with. And he was very polite, very soft-spoken, clearly upset with what he was hearing. But he didn't have that win at all costs mentality. And there's only a handful of these guys that do that. And I'll give them the benefit of the doubt at times, but in my thinking, once they cross this line where it's clear that they're willing to do whatever it takes to win this debate. You're just ideologue.
I mean, I give him the benefit of the doubt when it's related to, the research that I was involved in terms of him, you know, dashing off a couple of sources that I'm very familiar with, and I could have argued with him about, and then of course, you know, knowing that other sources existed besides the one he cited on the ice cord issue, you know, but that's a, I wouldn't say that he did not intentionally mislead there. He may have known about the others or, but it's, it would be a, I wouldn't be surprised if he had been prepped and that single source was the only one that was given him.
I'd agree with that.
And that it is the, his handlers who were the who used the furtive fallacy and he was just a tool.
Yeah, he was very much. I posted a stupid meme on Twitter a while back with, did you ever see the Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome movie?
Oh, yeah.
You know, I had John Hoops as the little midget riding around on the big guy's back, and the big guy's Flint Dibble, a useful idiot. He gets his ass whooped for it, but that is you know, when the Society for American Archaeology wrote a letter to Netflix trying to get Ancient Apocalypse turned into a fictional series instead of a documentary series.
Yeah.
I have it on from the mouths of archaeologists that were involved in that conversation that Flint did not want the racism part put in that letter. He but Hoops wanted it, and so it got left, and now Flint just carries that water. He doesn't care.
Yeah, right.
But that wasn't, like you say, he is being informed, but at the same time, it's like, you know, there's a certain point where, you know, you're being a useful idiot turns into just being an asshole. And
well, I'm not saying he's not an asshole.
No, I'm not saying that you're not saying that.
I didn't call him an asshole, but I'm not saying he is an asshole.
I'll say it.
He isn't an asshole. I wouldn't say that you're not an asshole. I think we could all be an asshole sometimes.
I ask my kid. I'm definitely an asshole. My youngest would tell you real fast. Oh, yeah. Right. Dad's an asshole.
Yeah, but, so anyway, that's basically, you know, my thoughts on that was that they are receiving information selectively. I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah.
If he didn't know about these other sources, I wouldn't be surprised if he was actually lying.
Yeah,
in that particular instance, or and actually filtered out the only paper that supported his point of view. So yeah, that's just what I'm saying.
No, you're fine. I tend to agree with you. Like he was when I saw the metallurgy thing, it was actually funny. I was already working on the video and was getting close to being done with it when I saw you on Joe Rogan right at the very end of it. You mentioned, oh, yeah, he's fucking wrong on the metallurgy. And I was just like, oh, shit. I hope somebody else doesn't jump under this. I'm like busting my ass on this video, all this research, and been working on it for days and almost a week or something now. And then Christopher Dunn just goes and lets the cat out of the bag to millions of people. But yeah, you'd said it a few days before my video dropped, if I remember right. Maybe even just a day or so. It was real close.
Yeah.
But yeah, I do remember hearing you say that, I forget exactly what you said, but it pointed out that he was wrong on the metallurgy thing, on the way that, and that he still, that's one of the things also that, regardless of whether or not he lied in the debate, right now he still is misrepresenting the way that they figure this stuff out to cover his ass. If there's no archaeological site, they will never, ever associate metallurgy with that time. If you have no archaeological site that has metallurgy from 12,000 years ago, they could have massive spikes in all of the right metals. They will never call it metallurgy if they don't have an archaeological site. They will attribute it to wind blowing it or to something else. They will look for another example. So and Flint doesn't, Flint just, oh no, that's not how that is. He just kind of sidesteps it. And that's, dude, he's a scientist misinforming the public about science in order to cover his own ass. I don't know how much more wrong it could get.
Yeah, I mean, basically, I be honest with you, Dan, I try to stay in my lane.
Yeah, I respect that. You know, you, Graham, It's kind of, I've said it a few times that I'm perfectly happy. I don't have a big pet hypothesis. I got a lot of things I dip my fingers into. I'm like, that's cool. I'm more happy to stand as kind of a bulwark between guys like you and Graham and Jimmy and Ben and all the skeptics that are assholes about it. So that I'll yell at them. And then I'll, if they have any good arguments, I'll come and ask you guys about it in a polite manner. And then they can deal with me. And well, I mean, that's kind of where they're at right now, where if they, you know, still don't see any responses or any response videos to Ancient Apocalypse Season 2 really up there yet from any of the main players. And I'm sure that some will come, but they're probably putting in extra research right now because they know that the open season's done. And I'm happy to do that. So
have you seen it?
Yeah. Well, Ancient Apocalypse Season 2. Yeah, it's great.
No, I haven't seen it yet.
Oh, yeah. It's really great. It's Graham did a great job. It's a lot of it's almost all focused on the Americas. Yeah. And there's a lot of interesting stuff, like the genetic difference between the like what may well have been like the Clovis culture and the people from South America. And they both basically they're finding that genetically that they showed up at different times from different places. And it's just a more complicated story than when we were taught in school, as we all well know. And
yeah,
Thor Heyerdahl's found a little vindication and all that kind of stuff. So it's fun.
Yeah. Well, I think we're coming up on an hour and a half.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, there's one other thing that I would like to make very clear.
Yeah.
In terms of the lost technologies, from my perspective, okay, it's immaterial to me whether all of these artifacts and pyramids and everything was created 500 years ago, 1,000 years ago, or 5,000 years ago. The only thing that I am interested in is the truth, and that the tools that would have been in existence at the time that these things were made are properly identified. And to date, they have not been.
That's a good way of putting it. I would agree with that. Like when you reached out to me, actually, I'll just say this for the viewers, because I'm sure you're well aware, but it was when I uploaded the video about the faces and how the symmetrical faces in ancient Egypt could have been done with a pointing machine, which is a low tech, but much higher tech than what we attribute to the Egyptians of having had. So that's where I really think that that science is kind of like the archaeologists involved in this are kind of they're throwing out the baby with the bathwater. You guys are bringing interesting data to the forefront that pushes these things to a higher level of technology. It changes what we know, whether you want to, whether they want to go with the woo or not.
Right.
The fact of the matter is you bring data to bear that they can't, that they just ignore instead of actually address.
Right. Well, you know, I mean, the symmetrical statues, I don't think anybody had talked about them before. I published my book in 2010, brought it to the world's attention. It was a shock to me. And so, you know, but in my book, you see, the thing is that people don't read books these days. So, you know, and so the information in my book has been kind of shared without context. Mostly. And so, you know, in my book, I say that, you know, all of these artifacts need further examination, because I'm just using rudimentary tools, advanced compared to what we credit the ancient Egyptians, but still compared to what is available today, even compared to what was available to me in 2006, 2007, 2008, when I was doing my research in Egypt have advanced significantly. So there is the tools are so much more advanced now. The software that they are attached to is equally more advanced, and I don't have the background, the skills, and the knowledge to use them tools because I have been retired now since 2013, and a lot of those advances came in around that, you know, through the years. Now my son is well versed in it, and you know, he's a he knows his stuff on the metrology and the scanning of artifacts because he scans aircraft parts every day for a living. But those tools, I think, properly applied in the right hands, because even understanding, you know, the industry, understanding geometry, and knowing how to use advanced software like PolyWorks, it would be important to get the most accurate information. 2D cameras are not are okay for, you know, they were okay for my purposes, but they're not something that would be used today. And so, you know, I'm going to leave it there. Is that, you know, it's basically being able to come up with good, solid information to inform the public correctly of what tools would have been required to create these artifacts. And then you look into the archaeological record, and then you have to explain, or you may want to explain why and how they disappeared, or if they would be found eventually, we don't know. But certainly to dismiss and not give the artifacts the respect that they deserve, because after all, you know, we have our counterparts of modern craftsmen who were working on them back in whenever they were made, and they need to be respected. And in order to be respected, they need to be understood in the most minute detail. Because as you have seen in the vase, the pre-dynastic vase, that the accuracy and precision is not debatable. I think what is now debatable is, and has been debated, is the provenance.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a funny one to me, because it's they could just, you know, go to the Cairo Museum and like petition to test some of the ones that are clearly pretty accurate that you can see in the glass. But when you're dealing with Egyptian antiquities that are on the open market, the provenance will always be an issue. Otherwise, it's not going to be on the market. But and guys like Matt Bell, I talked to him about it some, and he's like, yeah, you know, I buy these. And, come on now. I feel bad. But anyway, he said he bought these. I can't remember the name of the antiquarian, but he bought them from antiquities dealers that are reliable. Right. Mm-hmm. These are people that they're not just nobodies, and they're not going to risk their reputation over a $20,000 vase. And these vases only recently hit those kinds of numbers. You know, 15 years ago, you would have been hard pressed to get $500 for one. And that's, you know, that's a different ball of wax there. That's, you know, yes, lots of Egyptian antiquities are faked. That's not a question. But they tend to be scarabs and statues and things that people want to actually put on a shelf. A fucking vase? Come on. Yep. You know, that's only sticks out to somebody who's extremely knowledgeable in that stuff. It's a very niche market until Ben popularized the fuck out of them, to be honest with you. You wrote about him at length, but Ben's the one that was all over the internet running around making it to the point where I frequently refer to him as Ben's Vases, because even though he don't own any of them, everybody else does, but he's the one that talks about them.
Yeah, that's yeah, well, the driving force behind that whole research was Adam Young and Alex Dunn. Yes. And so, and Ben had a channel that dealt with these kind of subjects, and he popularized them, and he deserves credit for bringing them to people's attention.
Yep. Even though, again, like I said, you're the one that first started talking about them in the modern day, and that, like Adam Young and Matt Bell and a few other people, the ones that actually own the ones that you see getting tested. It's not
You mentioned museum pieces, right?
Yeah.
So, that is obviously the logical next step. I mean, and
clearly,
and that is going to happen. And I think there has been one expedition or one effort to gather data at the Petrie Museum from a vase. So there's information. There's work still ongoing. I mean, you know, to just dismiss it and you know, bring everybody into question and ridicule them, and you know, and create these silly little videos that criticize. That's not helpful.
No,
I mean we're all looking to know the truth.
Most of us are looking to know the truth. Some of us are just looking to get ad revenue. Like I said earlier, with the guys writing the article to piss off the other side, we're eating steak tonight, boys. That's all that they give two shits about, whether or not they figure out where these vases came from. How many clicks did that video get? Oh yeah. That's it. So you see it with
I think it's a fascinating. It's certainly a fascinating subject, and you know, and it was like, you know, I think somebody made the comment, well, I think Alex Dunn was just trying to prove his dad right. And so he kind of like, well, Alex Dunn may have been trying to prove his dad wrong, because you know how kids are, right?
That's a fair point. Yeah. And it's a kind of thing, I can understand why they would bring it, why they would point that out, but it's also the same kind of thing where it's like you're asking for a metrologist that's like a professional. There's right. Not what are you going to do, just go start knocking doors? You're going to go to Boeing yourself and email them, be like, hey, can you send me a list of your metrologists so that I can reach out to them to help me scan some vases? I mean, fuck, man, you're going to deal just like the vases, you're going to deal with what you got.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's the metrologists, and metrologists need a good chain of custody, right? So a metrologist will basically take an artifact and measure it, you know, using non-contact, you know, laser scanning or structured light scanning or whatever. But they do the scanning themselves, or they may analyze a STL file or point cloud taken by a trusted professional who knows what they're doing. So, you know, it's basically, there's a lot to it. And Alex can explain it more in depth than I can. He knows more about it than I do. So
yeah.
I'm just, you know, the old man.
Well, it's getting time for me to get off here to go get my
kid.
Yeah,
me too.
Okay.
All right, it's been good. So, yeah, mate, I think it's good. I think we covered a lot of ground.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that. We will be doing more, like I said. If you like this, hit the subscribe button and all those other things that you're already clicked off as soon as you saw my face saying, hope you liked that. Thank you very much and have a good day.